And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest, Adam Becker, has written What is Real? The Unfinished Quest for the Meaning of Quantum Physics. Modern technology today is driven by quantum theory. From LEDs and microchips in your phone to the nuclear hearts of the most distant space probes. Yet most physicists don't agree on what quantum physics actually means. Lay people and physicists alike are struggling with understanding what quantum physics says about the nature of the world around us. Adam Becker, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, well, we're really, really happy to have you here. Why don't you first tell us why you wrote this book?
Oh, that's a great question. So I wrote this book because quantum physics, as you said, is phenomenally successful. And in my training as a physicist, I learned quantum physics. And I went into my quantum physics classes being very excited to learn quantum physics, not only because I knew it was such a phenomenally successful theory, but because I didn't understand it. And I wanted to get a better understanding of what was going on in the theory and what it told us about the world around us. And what I found in my classes was that questions like, hey, what does quantum physics tell us is going on in the world? And, hey, what's going on with subatomic particles that obey quantum mechanics when we're not looking at them? The answers that I got to those questions were really unsatisfactory. I was basically told, don't worry about that. It's not a problem. It's not important for the theory. It still works. And that's not a satisfying answer. So I started looking into both what the answers to those questions were and why I was given such unsatisfactory answers, and the story I found there of the history behind the science and what was actually going on in the field was quite astonishing, and it led me to write the book.
And it's been a rigorous debate for over 90 years. Maybe without going into too much detail, you could give us a brief synopsis. First, define what Copenhagen, what that says, that particular theory, and then the interpretation of some of these other theories since the 1920s and kind of where we are today.
Absolutely, yeah. So that idea that I just that I was told in my quantum physics classes that I just mentioned, the idea that, we don't have to worry about what's going on in the quantum world of atoms and subatomic particles when we're not looking, it doesn't matter, what the theory tells us about the world around us. That idea is called the Copenhagen interpretation, and its slogan is shut up and calculate. It doesn't matter what the answers to these questions are. What matters is the theory gives us excellent predictions about the world around us. And it is true that the theory gives us excellent predictions about the world around us. I can't stress that enough. The theory works. It works phenomenally well. By most measures, it is the most successful scientific theory of all time. But that just makes the puzzle deeper, right? Because if it works so well, that means the theory must be telling us something about the world around us. Otherwise, why would it work so well? So, even though the majority position within physics for a long time, for most of the 20th century, was this shut-up-and-calculate approach, there have been other physicists who've been dissatisfied with that approach, dissatisfied with that Copenhagen interpretation. The most famous of them was Albert Einstein, but he didn't really come up with an alternative. He just said, this is unacceptable. And other people kind of followed in his footsteps and came up with theories that, or ways to understand quantum physics that, gave answers to the questions that this Copenhagen interpretation didn't. So, for example, David Bohm, he was a physicist at Princeton in the 1950s, and he came up with this thing called the pilot wave interpretation, which said that, this quantum world is really just a world of particles that are guided by waves. And these waves have some strange properties, like they can communicate with each other faster than light. But that's just the price for explaining the strangeness of the quantum world. And another physicist actually working at Princeton at around the same time, just a little bit later, named Hugh Everett, came up with an even stranger way of understanding quantum physics called the many worlds interpretation. And according to his interpretation, whenever there's any sort of choice in the quantum world, you know, a particle can go one way or another, the entire universe splits, which is an even stranger way of looking at things. But both of those things are strange, but they're better than saying shut up and calculate.
Adam, this reminds me of, remember when you were a kid and your parents would tell you to do something and you'd say, but why? And they'd say, don't make me explain it to you. Just do as I say. And that's kind of how it is with quantum physics. And truthfully, you know, John and I have been doing this show for 5 or 6 years, and we often have astrophysicists on the show, and even people who have written books like you on quantum physics. And we say, okay, you know, how do you explain quantum physics, say, if you're at a cocktail party? And inevitably, it's always said to us, oh, that's a really big question. That's really hard to explain. I can't explain it to you. Kind of like the parent. just trust me on this. So, what can you do with that for us?
Well, I can tell you that that's basically the subject of my entire book. So the thing that other people don't want to talk about is exactly the thing that I want to talk about. So that's a much shorter way of answering your earlier question of why did I write this book. I mean, this does come up when I go to parties, because, you know, people say, oh, what do you do? Oh, I wrote a book. Oh, what's your book about? Well, it's about quantum physics.
And if they don't walk away then...
exactly.
What do they say?
He knows how to kill a party, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this, because you, even in your introduction, there are a couple things that you say that I was able to really grasp, which I love to have something solid that I can grasp, especially regarding quantum physics. But, you know, a lot of people know that Schrodinger's cat, this story of this supposed experiment that actually never took place, explains and proves quantum physics. And you explain it really well. Can you do that for our listeners?
Absolutely. So the basic idea behind Schrodinger's cat, which was developed by this physicist, Erwin Schrodinger, who is one of the founders of quantum physics, the basic idea goes like this. Quantum physics seems to imply that subatomic particles can be in more than one place at once. Whether or not that's really what it implies is a complicated question, and that's part of what's at stake in this imaginary experiment of Schrodinger's cat, because Schrodinger thought, no, that can't be the whole story. It can't be the whole story that subatomic particles can be in more than one place at once. Or, you know, other people will say, oh, they're nowhere until you look. He said, you know, that's nonsense. You know, we live in a world made of subatomic particles, and yet the things in the world around us can't be in two places at once. And to demonstrate why this is a problem for quantum physics, he put together this thought experiment where he said, okay, imagine that you have a cat in a box, and you also have in that box a very slightly radioactive source, like something so, so, so slightly radioactive that it's only going to give off one particle of radiation, you know, in, say, half an hour. And you have a radiation detector, and that's hooked up to a hammer. And if the radiation detector detects any radiation, then the hammer will drop and smash a vial of poison, of cyanide, and that will kill the cat. So the idea is you put the cat in there, and you leave it in there for 15 minutes. So there's about, you know, a 50-50 chance that radiation will be emitted from this source. And radiation is very, very small stuff. You know, subatomic particles. So that's definitely obeying the laws of quantum physics. And what Schrodinger pointed out was, okay, well, if subatomic particles can sometimes be in two places at once, then after 15 minutes in the box, the radiation is both emitted and not emitted, which means that the radiation detector both goes off and doesn't go off, which means that the hammer both falls and doesn't fall, smashing and not smashing the vial of poison, and thus the cat is dead and alive before you open the box to figure out which it is. And Schrodinger said, you know, this is a serious problem, because maybe it is true that subatomic particles can be more than one place at once. They can perform all kinds of strange tricks. They don't have to obey our intuitions, or intuitions are about things in the everyday world. But it's definitely not true that cats can be both dead and alive.
Yeah.
So he said, you know, this is a serious issue. And if the theory is telling us that this cat is both dead and alive, and that is what the theory seems to tell us in this situation, then our understanding of the theory is incomplete or wrong in some way.
If you just join in. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. No. That's it's incomplete or wrong in some way.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Adam Becker, who has written a book, What is Real? The Unfinished Quest for the Meaning of Quantum Physics. I'm curious, did Schrodinger put that thought experiment together about the cat because it was a serious question on the table, or in a way, wink, wink, was he making fun of the theory that he came up with in the first place about how ridiculous it is?
He put that thought experiment out there to demonstrate what he thought was a serious problem with the way that the theory was understood. But he was in a minority, even though he was one of the people who first put together the theory. It was really widely accepted by the time that he put that thought experiment together that asking questions about what was going on in the box before you open the box was somehow meaningless or not scientific or not relevant to quantum physics. And he thought that that was just sort of, you know, physicists giving up on what made science science. And Einstein agreed with him, but Schrodinger and Einstein, by and large, were alone against most of the rest of physics in the 1930s complaining about this, when the rest of physics, most other physicists said, you know, no, the theory works fine. Why is this a problem?
Right. Maybe you can take a minute and help me with something. Because it's so difficult to understand, there's a lot of rhetoric out there in people who have come up with different interpretations, which are even more bizarre, and they're not trained to be able to do it. For an example, you talk in your book about Deepak Chopra, who talks about some of his views on the matter. There are New Age people that have put together these various pseudosciences. There are quantum charlatans that are promising healing through quantum.
Yep.
Maybe you can take a minute and tell us what we know to be true, like entanglement and what that means, and what is not true, because there is a lot of this rhetoric out there, a lot of this pseudoscience, which is confusing all of this conversation.
You know, that's a great question. I'm tempted to give a very short answer and say, just assume that anything Deepak Chopra says is wrong, which is, you know, a reasonable rule of thumb. But
I think Lynn just fell off the chair. Hold on. Lynn, you all right over there? this is a Deepak Chopra community, man.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
In any event, here are things that are true, or at least seem to be true, about quantum physics. It's true that quantum physics is a great theory that gives us accurate predictions about the world around us, helps us build phenomenal technologies, and explain all sorts of, you know, basic things about our everyday lives, like why the sun shines. It's also true that quantum physics seems to imply something like long-distance connections between, you know, far-separated particles that are sort of instantaneous, faster than light. But it's also true that we know that you can't use that to communicate, that, you know, that there's no way to sort of take advantage of that connection, or, you know, there's no way that that connection can somehow cause you to, you know, deliberately influence, you know, far distant things in the world around you in strange ways. So that's definitely not true. It's also definitely not true that, quantum physics tells us that consciousness is central in reality. There are a lot of people who say things like, you know, quantum physics tells us that we create the world around us. quantum physics tells us nothing of the kind. That's just false. It's a misunderstanding that is based on bad explanations of quantum physics that have come down through the decades. And it's certainly not true that quantum physics says that, you know, the power of the mind can heal any ailment in the body or in other people's bodies. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong. The mind is a powerful thing. We still don't completely understand how it works. But that's, you know, not really due to the strangeness of quantum physics. And while the placebo effect is an awfully powerful thing, you know, that still doesn't mean that, you know, the mind can heal absolutely everything about the body without any help. You know, and even if that were true, that wouldn't be a consequence of quantum physics. So anyone who says, you know, quantum physics tells me that, you know, I make the world around me, or that if I want something enough, then all I have to do is focus on it and it will come to me, that's completely unqualified lie. That is just incorrect. Quantum physics says nothing of the sort, and saying otherwise is a total misrepresentation of the theory. And it's not just me saying that. It is basically every physicist alive saying that.
So, Dr. Becker, you're saying that there's no truth to some of the things that have come out that said that at the subatomic level, the observer, depending upon their bias, determines the outcome of the particle's behavior. That's not true?
So that's slightly more subtle. It's certainly not true that the observer chooses what happens to the particle. That's definitely not true. It is true that quantum physics tells us that the world around us is, you know, at the subatomic level, a little jumpy and sensitive, that it's hard to prod an electron without having it go, you know, flying off in the other direction. That's simply because, you know, the quantum world is small and it's hard to observe small things without disturbing them. The role of observation in quantum physics is just that, you know, when large things interact with small things, it's hard for the large things not to massively disturb the small things. This has led to a lot of confusion and misunderstandings of quantum physics in the history of physics. You know, physicists themselves have said some strange things about measurement and observation in the history of physics. But I think that a lot of those things are really confused, and that the truth is both far simpler in a way, in that, you know, observation has much less of an effect on the world around us than we thought, but also far stranger in that, you know, oh, it's not that observation has a strong effect on the world around us. It's that, you know, quantum universes constantly split into some sort of multiverse, or that, you know, far distant particles can have some sort of instantaneous connection or some other very strange thing. But the intentions of the observer certainly have nothing to do with quantum physics.
Yeah, wow. Fascinating. So, Adam, let me ask you this. If, you know, we've talked about the uncertainty around quantum physics and the disagreement and the unsatisfactory answers.
Yeah.
Why does it, as you say, make such accurate predictions about the world that we see and experience? And why is there such phenomenal technology that has come out of the application of quantum theory?
That's another great question. So I think that the answer to that question is that quantum physics works very, very well because quantum physics has latched on to some feature of the world around us. In other words, there's, you know, the mathematical machinery of quantum physics, which gives us these great predictions, which, you know, tells us these, you know, amazing technologies that we can build. That mathematical machinery must in some way resemble something out there in the world, because if it didn't, why would it work so well? So in other words, there's something in the world of atoms, subatomic particles, photons, and in our world made of atoms and subatomic particles that resembles the mathematical structures within quantum physics. The question is, what does that mean? What is real in the world that looks like quantum physics? And answering that question is the job of physics. And saying, you know, shut up and calculate is to, you know, give up on that job and say, no, that's not actually our job. And thankfully, not everyone throughout history has decided to shut up and calculate. And instead, we have several good ideas about what could be in the world that is like quantum physics, why quantum physics works so well. In other words, the answer to your question. The problem is we don't know which of those theories is correct. And it's going to take more work and more time and possibly new theories in order to figure out what is going on in the world around us that makes quantum physics work so well. But there is certainly something out there in the world that resembles the mathematics of quantum physics in some way. Otherwise, the theory wouldn't work so well.
Our guest is Adam Becker. He has a PhD in astrophysics. He's written for the BBC and New Scientist. He's a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. And I'm wondering, for your students who show up in your class at UC Berkeley, what are some of the biggest questions that they have? And isn't recreational marijuana legal in California? I think it is.
Yes.
And you know, is that a prerequisite to showing up in your class to be able to kind of...
it
helps.
I've had people ask me after I give talks whether I have, you know, partaken in some sort of drug, whether legal or illegal in the state of California. And my standard answer to that question is, you know, no. I'm the sort of person who asks questions like what is real when I'm completely sober. So isn't that terrifying? I should also say I don't actually teach classes at UC Berkeley. Being a visiting scholar there doesn't mean that I teach classes there. It means that I'm sort of affiliated with Berkeley and I have, you know, access to campus resources, and I give talks in Berkeley sometimes, but I don't teach classes at Berkeley. But that being said, when I do talk with students about this, or when I talk with, you know, other physicists about this, you know, some of them will ask questions that are, you know, very straightforward, that you would think have straightforward answers, like what does quantum physics tell us about the world? And it turns out the answer is, you know, we're not sure. We have several competing ideas about that. And the look of relief on some of their faces when I say that is astonishing, because some other physicists will say to them, oh, you know, that's a bad question. Shut up and calculate. There isn't a thing in the world that's like quantum physics. Asking that question doesn't mean anything. But then the other thing that's interesting is that attitude of shut up and calculate sometimes leads to misunderstandings of some basic results in physics by professional physicists who, you know, have PhDs and are not students anymore. And, you know, they think that they know, for example, you know, if I tell them about these ideas of this guy, David Bohm, who I was mentioning before, the most common response I get from other physicists is, oh, but, you know, isn't that ruled out by, there's a thing called Bell's theorem, which I don't have time to get into. And I tell them, no, that's not only not ruled out by Bell's theorem, but John Bell was inspired by David Bohm's work. And their eyes become the size of dinner plates. And they realize that, you know, half the things they thought they knew about quantum physics were wrong. So this idea of, you know, basic questions about the world just don't have answers in quantum physics really impedes understanding of the theory.
So quantum is the study of the small and very close together. And let's say relativity would be the study of the very large and far apart, stars, groupings of stars, clusters of stars, galaxies, clusters of galaxies, the entire universe on the big side. So we don't want quantum to get an inferiority complex because there's a lot of questions just in general relativity that aren't answered. I mean, if 95% of all matter is dark matter and we don't understand it, there's some huge questions on that side as well. And that's why we have to keep studying this, and that's why we can't have a shut up and calculate. We need to shine a light on these things and be able to move things along through time as our understandings increase. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's certainly true that, you know, not every physicist should be working on the question of what does quantum physics mean. You know, there's no problem with someone saying, oh, you know, I'm not interested in that question. That's fine. The place where I get, you know, indignant, I guess, is when someone says, no one should work on that question. That's a bad question. That's an unscientific question. There's this sort of moralistic thing that's come along with the shut up and calculate, not, you know, I am going to shut up and calculate, but we should all shut up and calculate. And that's just where I draw the line.
Right. Well, putting aside the understanding of the theory, I just have a question about reconciling the two worlds between subatomic and our everyday life. Let's say, for an example, in my house, I have a computer. And on the other side of town, Lynn has a computer. We're not networked together, but let's say we have a point-to-point connection with a fiber optic connection. And let's say that I want to send her a file that includes the story collider story of you and Neil deGrasse Tyson, which is absolutely hysterical. If anybody would like to really hear a fascinating story, it's only about 12 or 15 minutes, but it's very, very cool. Go to Story Collider and look up our guest, Dr. Adam Becker, and maybe put Neil deGrasse Tyson. It's a great story. But back to my experiment. I'm sending this file to Lynn. So what happens with my computer, it grabs the file, and it turns it into binary, into bits, and it shoots these photons on this fiber optic line to Lynn's computer. Lynn's computer then decodes it and puts it in the format so that she can listen to the Story Collider story. It works. It's something that's we know that works, and that file will not get contaminated. Those photons are going to get to Lynn's house, and she's going to, you know, it's going to be great. But then you tell a story. It's not a story. It's an experiment. It's towards the end. I think it's in your appendix, which is talking about photons of light that sometimes decide to erase their past, sometimes decide to be two places at once. If that were the case with this experiment back to my computer and Lynn's computer, she would never get the file the way she's supposed to get it. But in the subatomic world, it's just so bizarre. It's hard to believe that you could base a technology of file sharing on quantum bizarreness. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. No, I think I understand what you're saying. I mean, so here's the thing. The internet and information technology as we know it, you know, you hear people talking about quantum computers, and that's, you know, a sort of technical term for computers that can perform certain tricks due to quantum physics. But the fact is that all of the computers we have right now are quantum in a sense, and that they all run on quantum physics. You know, we wouldn't understand how to build, you know, silicon transistors, you know, integrated circuits, the way that we do without quantum physics, because quantum physics tells us, you know, this is how semiconductors work. We wouldn't know how to encode information into, you know, pulses of electricity and light the way that we do without quantum physics. We wouldn't be able to do it nearly as well. So in one sense, the answer to your question is we can use quantum physics to build all of this amazing information technology because quantum physics gives us a better understanding of the materials in the world around us because those materials are made of these ultra-tiny particles, and once we understand how those materials work, we can manipulate them to perform all kinds of interesting tricks. But another answer to your question is, you know, there's this idea that in quantum physics, you know, the future can affect the past or something like that. That might be true. It's hard to say. But what's definitely true is that kind of strange effect, which I talk about in the appendix of my book and other even stranger particle physics experiments, which I didn't have, you know, room to talk about in my book. Those only show up in very, very precisely, carefully controlled laboratory experiments. That's not to say that, you know, quantum strangeness doesn't show up in the world around us. You know, there's all sorts of technology that's built on quantum strangeness, some of which, you know, is in our everyday lives, like, you know, LEDs, the displays on your phones and TVs. But these sorts of, you know, really troubling things that show up in quantum physics and that, you know, get us to question, okay, so what is real in the world around us? A lot of them really only show up in very sensitive laboratory experiments. Now, they're very robust laboratory experiments. The results have been confirmed and repeated around the world. So they're real experiments, and we have to deal with the consequences. But, you know, something like that isn't going to happen in the computer connection between, you know, you and Lynn across town.
Right. I heard you utter these words. It might be true. It's hard to say, Adam. It sounds a little bit like religion. or Deepak Chopra.
Well, okay, so here's what I'm going to say on that, and this is somewhat controversial, but I think this is right. Some people say, you know, the great thing about science is you don't have to take anything on faith. I think that that's, you know, not true, because, you know, you've always got to take things on faith, you know, even for really basic things. Like, you know, I have to take it on faith that the sun's going to rise tomorrow, right? Because for all I know, while I'm asleep, the laws of physics are going to suddenly and instantly change, and the Earth will go spiraling out of orbit, and the sun just won't be there in the morning. Or, you know, I have to take it on faith that, that, you know, all of my life experiences haven't been some sort of hallucination, and I'm not going to wake up tomorrow and be some completely different person or entity in some way.
Right.
So I would modify that statement that science doesn't take much faith. I would say, okay, or that science doesn't take any faith. I would say science doesn't take much faith. Science, in particular, the goal of science is to make meaningful and testable and real statements about what's going on in the world around us that require no more faith than the faith that it takes to just get out of bed in the morning and go through our daily lives, right?
Right.
You know, and I don't mean like, you know, the faith that gets you through those hard times. I mean the faith that tells you that, oh, if I'm hungry, I should eat, because in my experience, eating makes me less hungry. Now, that might not be true. It might be that you've been tricked your whole life, or that somehow the rules of your stomach have changed. But as long as you're willing to take it on, you know, if you're willing to have that minimal amount of faith that, yes, you know, eating makes me less hungry, that when I get out of bed in the morning, my feet aren't going to pass through the floor, that, you know, falling asleep will make me less tired, you know, when I wake up. As long as you have that very minimal amount of faith to sort of, you know, believe what you see with your eyes, and that, you know, your experiences in your life are, you know, indicators of what's to come, then that's all that you need to do science. And that's the level of faith that you need to do science. And the problem is that sometimes, you know, we don't know, we don't know how to understand what's going on around us. And I think that that's another thing that, you know, makes science look a little bit different from at least some religions, because some religions are very interested in certainty. You know, I have saying things like, you know, I have faith and that faith makes me certain of this thing. Science doesn't deal in certainty. Science says, yeah, that's probably true. We don't know 100% for sure, but, you know, we can put a pretty good figure on it. And it turns out it's 99.1009. It's never going to be 100%. And we can always be wrong. We just don't think that we are about a lot of very important things. And for the same reason that we think that when we eat lunch, our stomach will stop growling.
great answer.
Dr. Adam Becker has written What is Real? The Unfinished Quest for the Meaning of Quantum Physics. We want to thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.